Well, it's some months now that we've been considering Paul's epistle to the Romans, and we've studied the first 11 chapters. And I thought it would be good at this point to take a break before we look at the last five chapters. And it seemed like an appropriate opportunity, therefore, to resume our studies in Luke's Gospel. Some of you may dimly recall that during the first half of last year, we looked at the first five chapters of Luke's Gospel. And so it's my intention over the next few weeks to basically pick up where we left off back then. But not this morning. We'll leave that until next time. And that's because over the past week I've been struck afresh by what a great psalm, Psalm 77 is. And I'd like us to spend a few moments, therefore, looking this morning at Psalm 77, which we read earlier on. Now, Psalm 77 is a psalm of Asaph. Asaph was a Levite. He was an Israelite, in other words, of the tribe of Levi. And he was one of the men whom King David appointed to be in charge of the music at the tabernacle once the Ark of the Covenant had been brought back there. And it's very clear from the several psalms that have his name to them that David favored him in that way, not simply because he was a great musician. Clearly, Asaph was also a great man of God. And more than that, clearly, Asaph was what you and I might call today an experiential man of God. He was a man who knew both the exhilarating heights and the soul-destroying depths involved in being a servant of Jehovah. And more than that, it's also clear that Asaph was a man who understood that both the heights and the depths, indeed all the different points along the entire emotional spectrum, have their own legitimate place within the worship of God. And Psalm 77 is a classic example of that. Psalm 77 is a worship song, which you couldn't possibly sing with a big cheesy grin on your face and a kind of mindless, isn't it great being a Christian, attitude in your heart. Because Psalm 77 is a worship song, but one which reflects the real world of Christian experience. A psalm which reflects the real world that the Christian lives in, of struggles and problems and difficulties, and particularly the difficulty of doubt. More than anything else, Psalm 77 is about doubt. Doubt is the great theme of this psalm. Now, the doubt that this psalm is concerned with is not doubt as to the existence of God. But if I could just, at that point, digress for a moment, just to make this comment that particular doubt as to the existence of God, is a doubt which believers face. True believers struggle at times with that doubt. And if you're someone who struggles with that particular doubt, you mustn't think that that is the unforgivable sin which somehow disqualifies you from being a Christian. I think we can sometimes get into our heads, we're saved by faith. Therefore, our faith must be perfect. But that's absolute nonsense. If our faith were perfect, we wouldn't need saving at all. Our faith, as much as every other part of us, is a filthy rag. Of course it's not perfect. Our faith is inevitably flawed and unreliable and temperamental and inconsistent. It ebbs and it flows, it waxes and it wanes, and it will do that right up until the very day that we die. And so true believers certainly can and do struggle with that doubt at times as to the very existence even of the God that they love and live for. But this psalm isn't, as I say, about doubt concerning the existence of God. In this psalm, the psalmist is doubting his relationship with God. He's doubting, if you like, his salvation. And I'd just like to look at the psalm then under three distinct headings. First of all, this morning, the agony of doubt. The agony of doubt in verses 1 to 4. And so the psalmist begins then, crying out to God. Verse 1, I cried out to God, I cried out to God. Now, if you men were out mowing the lawn one day in the garden, and as you were clutching on to the handles of the lawnmower, you developed a blister on your thumb, you wouldn't at that point cry out to your wife back in the house, would you? You wouldn't at that point kind of throw your head back and emit this frenzied, desperate, blood-curdling scream. It just wouldn't be appropriate. You might, I suppose, wander in and mention to her in a rather disgruntled fashion that you've got a blister, but you wouldn't cry out. What would the neighbours think, apart from anything else? If, on the other hand, you were out there mowing the lawn and you accidentally chop your foot off with the lawnmower, then you would certainly cry out. Then you would scream, all right. Then you wouldn't care at all what the neighbours might think, because you are in agony. And here then, in verse 1 of Psalm 77, we see the psalmist in a situation that necessitates nothing less than crying out to God. Indeed, it becomes clear in verse 2 that the psalmist here is feeling almost a sense of bereavement. In Genesis 37, Jacob loses his son Joseph. And Joseph then, as he thinks, has been torn apart by wild animals. Joseph, as he thinks, has gone out of his life, never, ever to return. And so we read in verse 35 of Genesis 37 that Jacob simply refused to be comforted. And here at the end of verse 2, we have, I think, a deliberate echo of those words. Here you see, for the psalmist, God has gone out of his life, it seems, never to return. And so the psalmist, like Jacob, he too just refuses to be comforted. And indeed, just as Jacob, just as for Jacob, memory surely of happier days spent with his son Joseph must then have become so painful because they only highlighted the great void that there now was in his life. So the psalmist writes in verse 3, I remembered you, O God, and I groaned. Memories of happier days of wonderful fellowship and communion with God are now painful to the psalmist because they only highlight the void that there now is at the very center of his life. And then in verse 4, we have the picture of the whole fabric of the psalmist's everyday life, utterly in tatters, his sleep disrupted. You kept my eyes from closing. And even his most basic kind of social interaction profoundly affected. I was too troubled to speak. And so I'm saying then that in these first four verses, we have a graphic picture of the agony that a doubting believer goes through. Perhaps you know something of that in your own experience. Perhaps you know what it is to be so despairing of your relationship with God that all you can do is go into your bedroom, close the door, throw yourself on the bed and cry out to God. Perhaps you know something of what it is to feel that God is so distant and so remote that it's almost like a bereavement. God has gone. Perhaps you know something of what it is to be plunged into such hopelessness concerning your very salvation that you can't even sleep properly. You can't even engage in normal social interaction. You see, when we're talking about doubt, a believer doubting his salvation, his relationship with God, we're not talking here about some minor setback in the Christian life. We're talking here about something big. We're talking here about something that has the potential to throw a believer into real confusion, real turmoil, real anguish, real agony. And that's where we see Asaph then in the first four verses of this psalm. So that's the first thing, the agony of doubt. But secondly, this morning, the features of doubt. The features of doubt in verses 5 to 9. What are the features of doubt then? This doubt that we're talking about, doubting one's relationship with God, doubting one's salvation. What does that involve exactly? Well, I think we can identify a couple of things from these verses. First of all, an introspective spirit. An introspective spirit. We sometimes use that joking phrase, don't we, that so-and-so is an eye specialist. And we don't mean by that that the person works in a hospital performing surgical operations on the visually impaired. We mean that they're always on about themselves. They're preoccupied with themselves. I've done this, I've done that, I've done the next thing. Well, there's a sense in which this psalmist in verses 5 and 6 is a bit of an eye specialist. Not in the sense that he's preoccupied with his own achievements and his own successes, but in the sense that he's preoccupied with his own spiritual health. He's preoccupied with his own spiritual pulse rate. He's preoccupied with his own spiritual temperature. And so we have those words at the end of verse 6, my heart mused, and literally in the Hebrew it's, I mused with my heart, or as the King James Version captures it so well, I communed with mine own heart. And it's the idea then of this psalmist here, who we've already seen in verse 4, is struggling to interact with other people. And here we're seeing him now in verse 6, and it's as if all his interaction is simply with his own heart. That's all he can interact with now. He's lost the power to interact normally with other people. He's too troubled to speak. And it's as if he's just now pointing inwards and simply dialoguing and conversing with his own heart. Those native impulses that all of us have to commune with other people, to get to know other people in a deep and penetrating way. It's as if those impulses have been turned in upon himself. And he's simply communing with his own heart. And we have then a specific example of this in verse 5 and the first half of verse 6, where the psalmist recalls the past. He goes back to what he calls the former days, the years of long ago. And he looks back to how at that time he just was so in love with the Lord, that song would spontaneously break out. My songs in the night, he talks about in verse 6. He was just always wanting to sing to the Lord. There was just such zeal there, such energy there, such commitment there to the Lord God. But the implication is, you see, that now there's no longer those songs in the night. The songs have dried up. The zeal's gone. The spontaneity's gone. And the point is, you see, that the psalmist is obsessed by this contrast between then and now. I remember once talking to a professional artist who told me that one of the problems he faces is the constant impulse to contrast his present work with the best of his past work, and to become convinced, indeed sometimes overwhelmingly convinced almost, that he's lost his touch. And that he could never possibly regain his previous form. And it's almost that in the spiritual realm here. The psalmist, obsessed with this contrast between his spiritual experience in the past and his spiritual experience now. And so there's this introspective spirit then in the psalmist. It's all about him. It's all about his heart. It's all about his fluctuating spiritual experience. But then the other thing that we noted, the other feature of his doubt, not only an introspective spirit, but a questioning spirit. A questioning spirit. Look at that battery of questions that we have in verses 7 to 9. Will the Lord reject forever? Will he never show his favor again? Has his unfailing love vanished forever? Has his promise failed for all time? Has God forgotten to be merciful? Has he in anger withheld his compassion? There's almost a breathless feel to these endless questions. But what's interesting, I think, is not only the number of questions here, but the nature of these questions. Because some of these questions are simply absurd. Or at least they're absurd in the mind of a believer. Look at verse 8, for instance. Has his unfailing love vanished forever? Now that word here translated unfailing love is that wonderful Hebrew word that really means covenant love. Covenant love. It's talking about the way in which God's love has expressed itself in certain covenant commitments. Just like at a wedding, a man and a woman express their love for one another in covenant commitments. Do you so-and-so do such-and-such? I do. Will you so-and-so do such-and-such? I will. There's those great commitments. Love expressing itself in covenant commitment. And that's the love of God for his people. It's a love of I do's and it's a love of I will's. And so it's absolutely absurd to ask, has that love vanished? Has that love vanished forever? That love that God has solemnly committed himself to in vows, in promises, in covenant commitments, has that love vanished forever? It's absurd. Or then the next question, the same kind of absurdity. Has his promise failed for all time? Again, it's ridiculous, isn't it? The idea of a divine promise failing. A divine promise remaining unkept and unfulfilled and unrealized. It's absurd. Or the next question, has God forgotten to be merciful? You know how if someone who's normally fairly laid back and fairly calm and composed, if for some reason they suddenly have an outburst of anger, they might say afterwards, well, I'm sorry about that, I forgot myself. I forgot who I was. I acted out of character, in other words. And that's the kind of thing that the psalmist is talking about here. Has God forgotten that he's merciful? Has God forgotten his character? Is he acting out of character? Which again, is ridiculous, isn't it, for a believer to think that. To think that God could somehow just temporarily set aside his character and act in a way that was contrary to his character. It's ludicrous. It's absurd. And so, you see, there are all these questions. And you see, these things, they should be answers, shouldn't they? God's unfailing love, his covenant love, God's promise, God's merciful character, they should be the answers. They should be the great non-negotiable certainties that the believer is able to come back to, even if everything else is in confusion. But not for this psalmist. For this psalmist, there are no non-negotiable certainties anymore at this particular time. It's like the annoying child who just keeps asking the question, why? And you give him an answer, he says, yeah, but why? And another answer, but why? Another answer, but why? And it's like that for the psalmist here. That he just can't settle on any bottom line. There's no bottom line he can come back to. There's a why with everything, even God's covenant love, even God's promise, even God's merciful character. Why? There's questions, questions, questions. No finalities, no certainties that he can rest upon. So those are the two features then that we see of the psalmist's doubt. An introspective spirit, all about him, his heart, his fluctuating spiritual experiences. And then this questioning spirit, just unable to rest on any certainties. When you go to the doctor and you tell the doctor what's wrong with you, what your problem is, there's nothing worse, is there, than when the doctor kind of looks at you blankly as if he's never heard before of the symptoms that you're going through. That's not what you want. You don't want a doctor with a blank look upon his face. You want a doctor who nods reassuringly and says, yes, yes, I understand. And are you also experiencing this and this? And you say, yes, I am. And even then, if he is about to tell you you've got some terrible disease, at least you know that your case isn't unique and unprecedented. At least you know that you're not making medical history. You know that those symptoms are recognizable. The doctor has recognized them and has recognized a pattern in them. Well, if you're someone who perhaps in the past or even this morning has experienced or is experiencing this kind of endless introspection, looking in all the time, just dialoguing with your own soul, your own heart all the time, obsessed almost with your own spiritual performance, your own spiritual experience. And if you're someone who has just got endless questions, you can't fix on any certainties this morning. It's as if everywhere is sinking sand. You just can't find any bottom line. Well, at least you can be reassured that your case isn't unique and unprecedented. You're not making spiritual history. Your symptoms are recognizable even as far back as Asaph, in the very heart of the Old Testament scriptures. So we've seen then the agony of doubt. And we've seen, secondly, the features of doubt. But thirdly and finally, the elimination of doubt in verses 10 to 20. Because in this second half of the psalm, in these verses, the psalmist appears to get beyond his doubt. He comes out, as we might say, the other side. And we must ask the question then, how does that happen? What is it that gets the psalmist through this? How do his doubts evaporate and disappear? How does he come through them? Well, the answer really, in a word, is this. His focus shifts. His focus shifts. Verses 10 to 20 are all about a shift of focus. Follow this through with me, if you will. At a most basic level then, the psalmist comes to focus on what God has done. That's the most basic thing. That's the most basic aspect of this shift. The psalmist comes to focus on what God has done. You see, as we've seen in the first half of the psalm, it's all about him, focusing on him, his experiences, the state of his heart, what he's going through, his own spiritual health, what's going on in there, inside. That's the focus. But now, in the second half, he comes to focus on what God has done. It's as if his gaze is moved upwards and outwards to God, away from himself and to what God has done. You see this in many places. Straight away in verse 10, we read, "Then I thought, to this I will appeal." We'll come back to that later. There's a bit of a translation issue there. But he says, "The years of the right hand of the Most High." You see, back in verse 5, he's been looking back at his own history. "I thought about the former days, the years of long ago." He's been looking back at his own past, his own track record, his own history. But now, in verse 10, he looks at God's history. The years of the right hand of the Most High. In other words, at what God has done in the past. History from God's perspective rather than simply his own limited experience. What God has done. Verse 11, "I will remember the deeds of the Lord. Yes, I remember your miracles of long ago." Verse 12, "I will meditate on all your works and consider all your mighty deeds." Verse 14, "You are the God who performs miracles. You display your power among the people." So do you see there's this shift now away from all about him musing with his own heart, and now a shift out to God and what he has done in the past, his works, his miracles, his power, the great acts of God. So there's that most basic shift. But then we can become a bit more specific. And more particularly then, he comes to focus on God's redemptive act. He comes to focus on God's redemptive act. Verse 15, "With your mighty arm you redeemed your people." He's referring to the Exodus, of course, the great kind of redemptive event in the Old Testament when the children of Israel were brought by God out of their bondage and their slavery in Egypt, and they were released and they were brought out so wonderfully and so magnificently by God. That's what he's referring to. So this then again represents such a shift of focus. Not only now focusing on what God has done generally, but specifically on God's redemptive act. You see, we saw in those questions, in verses 7 to 9, those endless questions, we saw there that the psalmist should really have found some certainty there. He should really have found a bottom line there in God's covenant love and God's promise and God's merciful character. But he didn't. He couldn't find certainty there. He even questioned those things. But now you see, now he goes to the ultimate, non-negotiable certainty. What God has done in history, God's redemptive act. Even he couldn't put a question against that. Even he couldn't doubt that the Exodus had taken place. Even he couldn't doubt that the crossing of the Red Sea had happened. Even he couldn't undo history and reverse history. And so he comes to focus now on the ultimate, non-negotiable certainty, God's redemptive act. But then we can go further still, and more specifically still. He comes to focus particularly on the nature of that redemptive act. The nature of that redemptive act. Namely, that it's entirely of God. It was entirely of God. Isn't that what comes through in verses 16 to 20, this wonderful kind of poetical description of the crossing of the Red Sea? It's just portrayed as an amazing work of God. The waters saw you, O God, and they writhed and convulsed. And then it's your arrows flashed back and forth. Your thunder was heard in the whirlwind. Your lightning lit up the world. Your path led through the sea. This wonderful description of God parting the waters of the Red Sea and taking his people through. And you see, again, then we come back to the first half of the psalm. The psalmist was so introspective. He was worried, obsessively worried about his own fluctuating spiritual experience, the contrast between the past and the present, the way in which he was so much more in love with God then than he is now. And this is such a worry to him, such an anxiety to him. But now you see, he focuses on what happened at the Red Sea. And there at the Red Sea, how much had the Israelites contributed to getting across? How much had the Israelites contributed to crossing that sea? What hung on the performance of the Israelites? What hung on their ability? If the Israelites there at the brink of the Red Sea, if they had been full of faith, if they had been very low in faith, if they'd been full of fear, if they'd been very bold, it didn't make any difference. It was God who did it. Nothing to do with the Israelites. They didn't contribute to it. They didn't help God push back the waters. They didn't say, look, we'll give you a hand. They didn't somehow contribute to that miraculous crossing of the waters. It was nothing to do with them. It was all of God, entirely of God. It was a miracle of miracles. It was all from beginning to end of him. And so you see, here's the psalmist so obsessed with his own spiritual health, his own spiritual condition in the first half of the psalm. But now he comes to focus on what God has done, and particularly on God's redemption, and particularly on this, that redemption is all of God. It's not affected by whether I'm cold or warm, whether I'm hot or cold, whether I'm ebbing or flowing, whether I'm waxing or waning. It's all of God, all of him. And so those then are the kind of three stages in this, the psalmist's shift of focus. And I think it's still the same for us today. If you this morning are someone who is struggling with doubt, if you this morning are someone who perhaps is dominated by introspection and by questioning, then there needs to be a shift of focus. You need to turn outward from yourself. You need to fix your gaze elsewhere. You need to fix your gaze upon what God has done, his history, not yours. What he has done, his mighty acts, and particularly upon his redemptive act. And of course, for us, that isn't simply what he did there in Egypt. For us, ultimately, it's what God did at Mount Calvary through his Son, Jesus Christ. There, releasing not merely the nation of Israel from physical bondage, but releasing the entire church of God from spiritual bondage. Focus on that. And then focus on this, the nature of that redemption. What did you contribute to it? What's your role in it? Absolutely nothing. How did your spiritual temperature contribute to Jesus dying on the cross? Absolutely nothing. All of God. It was him from beginning to end. He did it. He accomplished it. Redemption is entirely of him. And I think that the psalm enables us very wonderfully to make that connection with the ultimate redemption, with Jesus Christ going to that cross. Because just as we read in verse 19, that God, as he redeemed his people back then, his path led through the sea. I'm sure it's not just coincidence. I'm sure it's a deliberate tapping into this kind of Old Testament language and imagery, that Jesus' path, as he went to the cross, led through the sea, as he walked that night across the Sea of Galilee, walking on the water, his footsteps, even on the sea itself. Focus on that. Remove your gaze from your own heart and from your own performance. That will inevitably lead to trouble. Focus your gaze on God, what he has done, his redemption through Christ and the nature of that redemption, all of him from beginning to end. But just as we close, two additional things to notice. First of all, notice that the psalmist now, in the second half of the psalm, he's able now to identify his doubt for what it was. Now this is where that translation issue comes in verse 10. In the NIV we have, "Then I thought, to this I will appeal," but I don't think that's probably the best translation. I think the older versions have there, "Then I thought, this is my affliction," or "this is my infirmity, but I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High." And it's the psalmist here, I think, realizing that what he's been going through in the first half of the psalm, all this doubt, it's an affliction. It's an infirmity. You see, he couldn't see that when he was in the middle of it. In the middle of it, he felt that God really had left him. That God really was distant and remote. That God really had failed in his promises and in his unfailing love and so on. But now, in verse 10, he can see it from a different perspective. No, that was my affliction. It was my infirmity. It was my view of things that was wrong. He can identify that he had been suffering from doubt. And he calls it, as I say, an infirmity, an affliction. That's what it is. It's one of those infirmities and afflictions that all of us will face from time to time on the way towards glory. So he's able to identify it. But then the second thing to notice as we close is perhaps the most wonderful indication of the change that has taken place in the psalmist's mind. In verse 13, where we have yet another question, and you're kind of thinking, oh no, not another question. We've had all those questions in verses 7 to 9. But notice now that it's such a different kind of question. "Your ways, O God, are holy. What God is so great as our God?" It's a different kind of question, isn't it? No longer is it a perplexed question. No longer is it a troubled question that's wanting an answer. No longer is it a fever-stricken question. Now it's a rhetorical question. Now it's a boasting question. Not boasting in himself, of course, but boasting in his God. Now it's a confident question. What God is so great as our God? This new air of certainty. Now he has finalities. Now he has certainties. Now he has a bottom line. It's a wonderful indication of the change that's taken place because he has shifted his focus. And I hope. And I pray this morning that if you are knowing anything of what Asaph was experiencing in the first half of the psalm, I hope that this morning, or very soon at least, you'll be able to, by shifting your focus away from yourself and to God, you will be able to come to this point where, instead of asking troubled questions, you can shout out loudly, "What God is so great as our God? The God of redemption, the God of Calvary, the God whose path led through the sea as he came to rescue me there on that cross." May God help us. Amen.